Okay. The point that I just made is extremely important because, by the way, I mean, that's as you well know, in the New Testament, the criticisms against the Pharisees is always that they're involved with the technical, the technical law. But the technical law is God's law. If you look at Torah and if you read the Bible, the five books of Moses, very clear that the law is quite technical, structured, and the structure is extremely important. So you have to realize that God perfects us through two different systems, and this is extremely important. I can't think of anything really more basic. One is through the rigid technical, and the other is through the philosophical, which is pliable. It is pliable in the sense that you have to apply yourself to the situation, and you have to use your own wisdom in doing so. So there are two systems in Torah, but you cannot say, a man cannot come along and say, well, I don't like the technical system. That's like, if he does that, what he's saying is he doesn't like God's Torah, but there are many, many verses there that deal with specifics, and especially in the area of Leviticus, in the area of uncleanliness, in the Bible itself openly, and in Deuteronomy, if you, anyone that reads the Bible, I don't have to tell you, it becomes pretty clear that in the last four books of Moses, there are technically structured laws. And this improves, each one of these things improves us in a certain way, in a certain fashion. We cannot say, well, I don't like the technical, I like the philosophical, or vice versa. That is not acceptable. A person who accepts Torah has to accept both systems. Both systems improve us. They're equally important. And you have to know which is which, and you have to become educated and learn exactly what is meant by the technical law, and learn how to use it, and learn how to what the philosophical law is, and to be able to differentiate between those two categories. But I really can't think of anything more basic in Torah. I mean, that's an extremely important point. Folks, I would suggest that if you're having difficulty with it, I would suggest that you go over this point, and that if there is any difficulty, I would be glad to try to add clarification, due to the fact that I really think it's extremely important. What I'd like to do tonight, really, what I had in mind tonight was, David mentioned to me that the concept of the land of Israel is one that you would be very interested in, and I think it's extremely important philosophically to understand what exactly that means, the importance of the land of Israel. And the way we arrive at that is the same way that we arrive at anything else, through the study of the Torah itself. So we don't just sit down and create our own ideas. We have to look at God's Torah and see what God says about this. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to be interrupting the ordinary Talmud session, and I'm going to deviate and go on to a different point for a while. Then we'll come back to the Talmud. But I was thinking also that occasionally I might do this because it's extremely important to study the fundamentals of Torah. I mean, there are a lot of fundamentals. So we're going to leave Talmud for a while, and we will return to it as soon as we finish with this topic. I guess this might mess the tapes up, but not too much I can do about that. Okay, now, as you know, there are 13 principles of faith. Now, the eighth principle of faith, and the eighth principle of faith that Maimonides has in his 13 principles, is the fact that the Torah is not simply historical record, and that there is no difference in the Torah between when the Torah gives the list of the kings, for instance, by Esau, it gives the alufs, the chieftains, and the kings. There's no difference between that verse in the Torah and between the verse in the Torah that says, I am the Lord your God that is taking you out of Egypt, the first commandment and the Ten Commandments. That this is all given by God, and because it's given by God, it is not only true, but it contains infinite depth and infinite wisdom. Because nothing that God creates is devoid of wisdom. That is another basic principle of our faith. Therefore, we say that when the Torah gives you these facts, the Torah tells you these stories or gives you these facts, there are ideas behind this that we ought to search for. And we're not merely to look at it as a historical record. That's not the purpose of Torah. Torah is not history. Torah is ideas and teachings. So if someone should say that the Torah is parts of the Torah, just a historical record, then they would, in essence, be an apostate. And that's the eighth principle of faith of Maimonides. So what I'd like to do, we're going to take up the subject of the land of Israel, and what I'd like to do is go through the Torah itself and see how this idea develops. Now, before I do, I just want to mention that that when we read the Bible, most people that read the Bible are prone to think in terms of stories, like sort of they have like sort of a fairy tale attitude towards the stories. And I'd like to just point out the reasons for that. I think it's important to understand the reasons. The first reason is because we learn these stories when we're very young. And since we learn the stories when we're very young, they have this fable story kind of feeling. And when we get older, we retain that feeling and forget to revise our study of these stories. We look at them as the same way as we did when we were children. So that is one reason, and that's something which a person should be aware of and should realize that the Torah is written in a certain fashion. And that fashion is that it's almost like it's written in scales, in levels, different levels. The surface level is simple, but then when you go beneath the surface, it gets deeper and deeper and is infinite in wisdom. So we have to remember that when we read the Torah, we shouldn't read it as we did when we were children. We have to revise our understanding and our approach, essentially, to these stories. That's the first point. There's another reason why, when people look back at the stories in the Torah, they have a sense of sort of like a story type of feeling about it. And the second reason is because there's a general tendency in man to think of the people that lived in the past as not being quite as real as we are today. There's a general trend like that. The reason for that is because of our fear, our own fear of our own mortality. Every person's greatest fear is actually to recognize their mortality. I was just speaking to a young woman in her 30s who just had a problem with her gums, and she had some work done, and she told me, she says, the main thing that bothered her was not the work on the teeth, which was very painful, but she says the recognition that she's in her mid-30s and the recognition of her own sense of mortality, that parts of her are starting to go, and this is something which is very frightening for a human being. And because of it, what man does is he tries to block out certain things in order to not to face that fear. One of the methods he uses is to consider the lives of people in the past as not being quite as real as our lives. Because if theirs was as real as ours and they are gone, this kind of indicates that our existence is just as tenuous as theirs, and we will soon suffer the same fate, which is a frightening concept. Now, it's an interesting thing. There is one book in the Torah that is really dedicated to the idea of man coming to grips with his mortality. Now, does anyone know which book that is? It's one of the books. Every book in the Torah in the prophets has a different topic. And this book, the essence of this book, it runs through the book like a red thread, I would say, the idea of human mortality and the idea of coming to grips, man's struggle with his mortality and his inability to really face it. That book is Ecclesiastes, okay? That's King Solomon's book, Ecclesiastes. And Ecclesiastes, that's why Ecclesiastes has a very kind of, people look at it as a depressing tone. And it's, for instance, it says, vanity of vanities, saith Koheleth. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What benefit is there in all the labor that a person labors under the sun? A generation comes, a generation goes, and the earth exists eternally, which means that a person recognizes that he's just a part of a cycle. The last generation went, his generation is coming, so the person has a certain sense of weakness and futility in his life. But the Torah doesn't hide anything. The Torah demands that we face up and not try to fool ourselves. So the book of Ecclesiastes is really is written precisely for that reason, to teach a person how to struggle with this greatest of all fears, the fear of a person's own mortality. But there is one verse in the beginning, in 1:11, which really has what we were discussing. In 1:11 it says, in Ecclesiastes 1:11, there is no remembrance of the former beings. And then it says, and also the ones who live at the end, there will not be any remembrance for them with the ones that exist at the end. Now it seems like a contradiction, because it says there's no remembrance to the people who lived many years ago. And even the ones that live at the end, they're not going to be remembered either with the ones that live all the way at the end. So it sounds like a contradiction. But really what Ecclesiastes is saying is very simple. You just have to look into it a little bit deeper. What he's saying is that we don't remember the people of the past. We don't remember. We forget. I mean, we forget because how many people know their great-grandfather? Very few. Great-great-grandfather? No one. So these people are really out of our minds and as if they never existed. But even the people that we know of that existed, somehow or other, we don't ascribe to them the same amount of reality as we do to our own lives. But then Solomon says that, but even the people that are existing at the end, by that he means like us, even people that are existing now, they're not going to be remembered later either. So what he's saying is that a person should recognize the fact that this is all a fantasy. In other words, just like you think that those people that lived years ago weren't actually living as you are today, you should realize that people are going to look at you the same way in the future. So King Solomon is pointing out a little bit of reality to people, that the reason why you don't ascribe the same amount of reality to people of the past is because they died, and yes, you have a fear of identifying with them and then facing your mortality. But you should realize that this is not true in reality, because people are going to say the same thing about you. So what that verse means. So in general, there's a tendency to think of people in the past as not being quite as real. And as a matter of fact, even historians commit serious errors in this regard. Thor Heyerdahl wrote a book about Easter Island. It was a very interesting book. I read it years ago. And what he showed was that archaeologists make a big mistake in the fact that they think that the people who live in the past weren't quite as intelligent as us. And they do it, like, not directly, but sort of indirectly. And he shows how brilliant the people were in getting these gigantic statues to stand up that even scientists could not figure it out. And there was someone who had a tradition that was carried down for generations and knew exactly how to do it. And he told, it took Thor Heyerdahl a year to gain his confidence, but once he gained his confidence, he disclosed the secret to him, and then they did it. It was quite simple. And so Thor Heyerdahl makes a point of saying that people have a tendency, even historians and archaeologists, because they're also people, have a tendency to think of people in the past as not being quite as intelligent as we are today. And the reason is because, again, it's because of what the wise Kalman brings out. It's because of our fear of mortality. So our life is somehow more real, more full, we're really living. And they, you know, they sort of didn't live as well. And they weren't as intelligent, and we take away a lot of qualities from them. When it comes to the Torah, of course, it's really a distortion. Because here we're dealing with God's book, which is more advanced than any book of today or any concepts of today. And people always try to project onto the Torah primitivism, or they don't feel, even if they don't do that, somehow or other the stories of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they don't really give them their due because of the same reason, that these people existed in the past, and we can't really treat them as ourselves, because then we are liable to come in contact with that great fear of facing our own mortality. So that is the second reason why I'd say people don't look at the Torah, the stories in the Torah, with depth and with understanding, because they fail to ascribe to them the same type of knowledge, at least the same kind of knowledge that we have. Of course, the knowledge of the Torah is far, far deeper, and Abraham was a much deeper person than anybody today. Okay, so that's the second reason. The third reason is happens to be because of the style of the Torah itself. And by that I mean that the Torah is written in a very strange way. For instance, and Rabbi Soloveitchik pointed this out, but it's pretty obvious. Abraham was, after all, a human being. Does anyone know how tall he was, short he was? Was he heavy set? Was he thin? Was he light-complected, dark-complected, ruddy? No one knows. The Torah simply doesn't tell us. Doesn't describe Moses, doesn't describe Noah, does not give us these descriptions that we find in every other book that we read. Even today, the literature is, that's part of literature, a great part of literature, description. The Torah, somehow or other, God just took that out, skipped it. The prophets are more. Prophets really have much more description. If you read, for instance, Samuel 1 and 2, so you have, it speaks about King Saul. It tells you he was tall, handsome. He was higher from his shoulders and above all the people. It speaks about King David. He was a redhead and nice-looking. It gives us the prophets give much more description than the Bible itself, and I don't think that's coincidental. I think there's a reason for it, and the reason is that the Torah was written by God, and the prophets were written by people. Let me elaborate a little more on that point. You see, we have a principle in the Torah that once after Moses, no new laws or new ideas can be given. And that's why, by the way, the Torah ends with the death of Moses. And many historians, Bible critics, wonder why is that so? Should it end? The story should end when the Jewish people enter the land of Israel, like any other story. That should be the climax. That's what you're trying for. But no, it ends suddenly with the death of Moses. And the reason is because the Torah is not a storybook, but the Torah is a book which has a very unique essence, and that is that it was given by God through one person, Moses. And after Moses, it is not the same thing anymore. And the prophets were great people; they were inspired. But the Torah was given word for word by God to Moses. Hello? Is anyone there?
Yeah, we're still here.
Okay, good. Okay, I just
thought. You woke everyone up with the first hello.
Okay.
That was a dreamy message there for a few seconds. No, I'm kidding. Nobody was. There were only 10 people asleep. I was lying. Not everyone. No. But you said hello. I thought everybody thought somebody was at your house. Did you have hello again?
Yeah, I don't know why, but I thought the phone got, you know, it's very hard for me to tell. I thought the phone got disconnected. It sounds dead.
No, you're doing great.
Okay. Now, the difference between God's book and the prophets is that God, when God wrote the Bible, he had a focus on a certain development. It's a developmental course. From creation not too much about, through Noah, which doesn't have that much about that either. Then with Abraham, you have an expanse. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Then with Moses, then you have the whole Torah. So the Torah is not written, God did not write the Torah as a historical record, but the Torah has a certain focus of knowledge. And because of that focus, God deleted certain things that would take us off the track. It's not important what Abraham looked like. That's not important. God didn't want to distract us with that kind of a... that would be a distraction from God's course. The course of the Torah is... The ultimate course of the Torah, of course, is known only to God. And the focus, the ultimate focus, known only to God. We, if we study the Torah, we start to see what that focus is. But we, of course, can, as God does. But because of that fact, God deletes, there's omissions, gaps, and it's written specifically with a certain developmental concept in mind. That's why you have many, many years swallowed up in a few verses, and a few years expanded in books over a number of books. That's the way God wrote the Torah, because God is concerned with the ideas behind the Torah. Now, a prophet cannot do that. See, a prophet has no right to do that. A prophet has the right, like a biography or like a historian. Of course, he has great knowledge and he knows what's important, what's not important. But he has to write about what's important at the time. If King David's appearance was important at the time, and it was a factor because a leader's appearance is important, or King Saul's, then the prophet noticed that this was an important thing. It had an impact on the people at the time. He has to write that down. He has to be faithful to the record as a biographer. Of course, being a great person, he's not going to write like an ordinary biographer. He of course, has he deals with concepts and ideas of Torah. But nevertheless, he cannot take the liberty of omission. That would be as if he would be in violation of the fact that a person, a human being, has no right to create his own focus. That only God could do. So that's why the Torah is different than the prophets. The prophets were inspired by inspiration. Maimonides explains inspiration. Inspiration means that the prophet was able to devote an abnormal amount of energy and concentration to his task. He was able to think more deeply than an ordinary person would be able to. He was able to summon all his energies and concentration. That's divine assistance. He had divine assistance in writing his writings. But it was nevertheless the work of a human being, as opposed, not to be compared, to the work of God, which is the five books of Moses. Okay, so that's why the prophet wrote as a faithful and Torah-minded biographer, whereas God, who knows what his focus is, he omits, deletes, and has gaps according to the way he sees fit. So that's the third reason why the Torah, people look at the Torah as unreal, because have an unrealistic sense about it. I mean, people who believe in Torah don't look at it as unreal, but there's a certain amount of, as I said before, like lack of ascribing of the proper amount of reality to it. And the reason for that is because of the style of the Torah, and the style of the Torah is that things are deleted which are not really in the line of the course, the main highway that God is creating, so to speak, in the Torah. So things that might interest us, like what Abraham looked like, God did not wish to be part of the Torah. And as a result, if a person just looks at it superficially, he's missing this kind of satisfaction. And it takes away from his sense of reality as to the figure of Abraham. But what it should do, really, is it should inspire a person to look into the work deeply. And then he will see that he will have a greater idea of Abraham in terms of the person and his ideals and his ideas, which is the real Abraham, will emerge from the study of the Torah. But if a person doesn't do that, he's left sort of, he doesn't have the ideas, and he doesn't have the description. So it's sort of like it becomes like a figure that is not real in his mind. Okay, so that's the third reason why I would say people don't give the stories in the Torah their proper their proper place in their minds. All right, now what I would like to do is, I would like to take a part of the Torah, and which has to do, we will eventually explain the concept of the land of Israel, and what we have to do for that is to go to the very beginning, which really is in Genesis 12. Okay? Genesis 12 is where God says to Abraham, he says, go forth, 12:1, go forth from your land, from your birthplace, from the house of your father, to the land which I will show you. And then in verse 2, and I'll make you into a great nation, I'll bless you, I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing, and et cetera, et cetera. Okay? So, here when a person looks at this verse, or these few verses, a person gets an impression, wow, it's so nice. I mean, here God is taking this man Abraham, and he's telling him, I'm going to take you, leave your land, and I'm going to take you to this wonderful place. We conjure up a very idyllic image in our mind, and it's, we think, well, that would be great if that would happen to us. It would be just wonderful. But when you look closer at the verse, you see that, again, you're ascribing a story kind of attitude to the Torah, but when you look at the verse does not tolerate such a thing. Take a look at verse 1. It says, God said to Abraham, go forth from your land, from the house of your father. We have to understand why you need all these places. And it says, to the land which I will show you. Okay? So God does not tell him where he's supposed to go. Now, an intelligent person will ask the question, how did Abraham know where to go? God says, I will tell you. But meantime, he tells him, leave. So in the same verse, he tells him, leave, and he says, go where? To the land which I will show you. Well, what is he supposed to do now today, before God shows him? He's supposed to pack his bags and leave. Does he go north, south, east, west? Which way? Where does he go? All right? So when you look into the verse, you see, it's not quite as simple as one would think. Now, here's where the oral law and the scholars of the oral law come in, and Ramban is one of them. And
Rabbi, we got 1 minute.
Okay. Okay. Ramban says that actually what happened was that Abraham picked himself up and was a nomad. He didn't know which way to go. He just happened, he took one direction, and actually it was south. But turned out it was correct. But that's not the point. The point was, he did not know where he was going at the time, and he just left. As a matter of fact, Nachmanides, Ramban says, that he wandered around like a lost sheep. And if you take a look at one of the verses later, you'll see a precise corroboration of that idea. Well, I guess we'll have to take it up next week because I think we're running out of the time. But we will continue on an analysis of this whole part of the Bible. Okay, thank you.